Hello, it's Monday the 14th of April and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. Former President Yoon Suk-yeol's criminal trial on charges of leading an insurrection on December 3rd when he put the nation under martial law officially began today. We'll have more details in news briefing shortly. Coming up for Weekly Economy Review, we discuss US President Donald Trump's decision to press pause on the reciprocal tariffs and how South Korea needs to prepare for future negotiations. And then on Monday, Sports Roundup, we'll look at Kim Young-kyung's bowing out in glory with a championship title, as well as the latest from the KBO and the KBL playoffs. Let's begin today's Korea 24. Former President Yoon Suk-yeol appeared at the Seoul Central District Court on Monday as he stood trial for criminal charges of leading an insurrection on December 3rd when he put the nation under martial law. The trial officially began today. The prosecution argued that Yoon intended to orchestrate an insurrection for the purpose of subverting the nation's constitution. Yoon rebutted the indictment, claiming it does not conform with legal principles. For this and our other major headlines of the day, we have in the studio with us Deputy Editor-in-Chief of KBS World's English News Service, Kim In-kyung. In-kyung, hello.
Hello, Jang-woo.
So can you sum up the hearing today, which began at 10 a.m. and then ended in the evening?
Yoon arrived at the Seoul Central District Court via the underground parking area at 9:50 a.m. ahead of the first hearing. As the accused, Yoon must attend the hearing in person. The court began the hearing by confirming Yoon's identity, and the prosecution outlined the charges against him. The prosecution argued that the former president planned to incite an insurrection to subvert the nation's constitutional order by, among other things, trying to block the National Assembly and the National Election Commission from exercising their powers through the deployment of police and martial law forces. Yoon directly disavowed the allegations against him, saying his martial law move did not amount to an insurrection. He said he reviewed past insurrection cases and did not believe there were legal grounds to indict him over a non-violent event that lasted only a few hours and immediately ended at the request of the National Assembly. Yoon later asked the prosecution to display its presentation on the courtroom monitor to prevent prejudice, claiming that during his impeachment trial, many statements were made unilaterally by investigative agencies involved in the case and not verified. Two senior military officers took the witness stand in the afternoon. Cho Sung-hyun from the Army's Capital Defense Command testified that he was ordered by a superior officer to send troops to drag lawmakers out of parliament during Yoon's martial law order. The next hearing will be held next Monday, also at 10 a.m.
Yes, we'll see what comes out of that second hearing next week. Moving on, a KBS poll has found that the former Democratic Party leader Lee Jae-myung is in the lead by a large margin among presidential hopefuls for the June 3rd snap election. Can you tell us more?
Sure. In a nationwide survey of 3,000 adults conducted by Hanguk Research from Tuesday to Thursday last week, 38% of respondents said they would vote for Lee if the election were held tomorrow. 13% chose former Labour Minister Kim Moon-soo. Also on the conservative side, former Daegu Mayor Hong Jun-pyo came in third with 6%, followed by former People Power Party Chief Han Dong-un with 5%. PPP lawmaker An Chol-soo and new Reform Party leader Lee Jun-seok each secured 3% of the vote, and former PPP lawmaker Yoo Seung-min and Gyeonggi Governor Kim Dong-yeon each received 2%. 51% of respondents expressed a preference for a candidate from the previous opposition bloc to win the next presidential election, while 36% favored a candidate from the previous ruling bloc. The survey had a confidence level of 95%, with a margin of error of plus or minus 1.8 percentage points.
Now, one of the potential contenders you mentioned is conservative heavyweight Yoo Seung-min, but he announced over the weekend that he wouldn't run. Can you tell us more?
The presidential nomination race for the People Power Party is rapidly changing as two moderates have backed out. Yoo announced on Sunday that he will not be running in the party's primary, saying that the Conservative Party has seen two of its presidents impeached, but is still refusing to reflect and change. He said the party is not expanding its conservative territory by moving toward the center, but is gradually narrowing it. His announcement came a day after Seoul Mayor Oh Se-yoon declared that he would not run in the presidential election, criticizing the party for not properly reflecting on the impeachment of former President Yoon Suk-yeol.
Now, on the conservative side, one of the big questions is whether acting President Han Duck-soo will run. What's the latest?
Han still remained silent on the issue but said during a cabinet meeting on Monday that responding to the ongoing trade war is his final mission, raising speculation that he won't run. Also on Monday, former Daegu Mayor Hong Jun-pyo declared his candidacy, saying the upcoming race will be a choice between him and former Democratic Party chief Lee Jae-myung.
On that note, Lee held his first public event on Monday after declaring his presidential bid last week. Can you tell us some more?
The event focused on technology and the economy as Lee is trying to woo moderate voters with his hold on the Democratic base firm. He pledged big investments in artificial intelligence during a visit to the headquarters of an AI chip startup in Seoul. In a Facebook post earlier in the day, Lee revealed his plans to invest 100 trillion won, or roughly $70 billion, to enhance South Korea's global competitiveness, calling AI a game changer that will reshape the global economy.
And what about other contenders from the Democratic Party? What have they been up to?
Former South Gyeongsang Province Governor Kim Kyung-soo visited the Seoul National Cemetery to pay his respects at the grave of former President Kim Dae-jung. Kim, who declared his candidacy on Sunday, said the next president shouldn't spend a day at the presidential office in Yongsan, calling it the headquarters of an insurrection. He earlier pledged to relocate the presidential office to Sejong City. Meanwhile, some DP contenders openly expressed disappointment over a proposed change in the party's candidate nomination rules, which they say favor Lee Jae-myung. The new rules would have votes from dues-paying party members count for 50%, with the results of a public opinion poll counting for the other 50%. Gyeonggi Province Governor Kim Dong-yeon criticized the move for destroying the party's principles and traditions, but later said he will accept it.
Turning to the latest news on tariffs, U.S. President Donald Trump said he will be announcing tariffs on semiconductors over the next week and also indicated that he might offer flexibility to some companies. This is raising questions about whether there will still be tariff exemptions for certain imported electronics products, as the White House said last week. So what's the latest?
President Trump said Sunday aboard Air Force One that he will be announcing tariffs on imported semiconductor chips over the next week, but he also indicated that he might offer flexibility to some companies in their sector. Earlier in the day, Trump said in a Truth Social post that there are no tariff exemptions for imported electronics products and memory chips. This all comes after the U.S. government initially announced there would be tariff exemptions for certain imported electronics products, including computers, memory chips, and semiconductor devices. In the social media post, Trump stressed that tariffs will apply to electronics products, apparently clarifying guidance issued by the U.S. Customs and Border Protection on Friday that seemed to suggest he'd stepped back from his hardline stance. The Truth Social post said those products were simply moved to a different tariff bucket and that no country was off the hook for its unfair trade balances and non-monetary tariff barriers against the U.S., especially not China.
Returning back here to South Korea, after a huge sinkhole appeared Sunday near a construction site on the Busan Metro's Sasang Hadan line, another one opened up on Monday during road excavation work. Can you tell us more?
Sure. According to Sasan District, the second sinkhole appeared around 7 a.m. near Saebyeok Market, measuring 3 meters in diameter and 2 meters deep. It was some 200 meters away from Sunday's sinkhole. An official in charge of the construction work was quoted as telling the district office that it was not a typical sinkhole, but the result of a road collapse during the excavation process. Sinkholes have occurred 14 times in the past 3 years near construction sites along the Sasang Hadan line.
And that's where we're going to leave it for our news briefing today. Thank you for bringing us the stories.
Thank you.
In a stunning reversal, U.S. President Donald Trump last week announced a 90-day pause on his so-called reciprocal tariffs amid global market turbulence, all except China. He said the pause on the country-specific tariffs would allow countries to reach bilateral deals with the U.S. In South Korea, acting President Han Duck-soo called on the government to make every effort in negotiations with Washington to ensure that the tariffs do not loom over South Korean exporters. However, concerns remain as Trump has hinted at the possibility of a package deal that could mean renegotiating the country's defense cost-sharing arrangements. To get some expert insights and perspective on these latest developments for this week's Weekly Economy Review, we're joined in the studio by economics professor Yang Jun-suk from the Catholic University of Korea. Professor Yang, hello. It's great to have you with us.
Happy to be here.
Yes, so the world braced for tariffs. In fact, stock markets around the world tumbled, but there's now been a 90-day reprieve. What's your take on Trump's decision? Have you found keeping up with all the changes? What do you think caused the Trump's 90-day pause on tariffs?
Okay, well, let me first point out the change in sort of mind frame that people have. Now, if you look at the actual tariffs that are being charged right now, there's 10% tariffs on everybody. Korea still has 25% tariffs on automobiles. We have 25% tariffs on steel and aluminum. There's going to be a automobile parts tariff that's going to hit in early May. So people who crunch the numbers, they point out that, okay, it's not as high as we thought it was going to be at the beginning of last week, but this is still the highest tariff rate. It's around slightly below or slightly above where it was during Smoot Hawley. The reciprocal tariffs were delayed for 90 days, but tariffs are still there. It's still at a very high level. It's just amazing that because the reciprocal tariffs were delayed, people think, okay, we're free. But it's still the largest increase in tariff that we've seen in the United States in the post-World War II period.
Right.
Having said that, what made Donald Trump blink? It was not the international outcry. It was not the domestic outcry that prices are going to go up or companies cannot invest. It was the bond market. Tariffs were imposed, and it was imposed for about a day. The yield on 10-year U.S. Treasury bonds, which had been hitting slightly below 4%, that started rising very quickly. Within, say, about 2 hours, it went up by about 0.5 percentage points, hitting a high of 4.51. And that is not only very unusual, it actually scared the financial market. It apparently scared both Treasury Secretary and the President Trump. And that is reportedly the big reason why the tariffs were delayed.
Right.
Now, why did the interest rate rise? Well, technically, interest rate or yields on bond rises when price falls. So somebody was selling a lot of government bonds, U.S. Treasury 10-year bonds, and nobody was quite sure why. It could have, at least at the time, they thought that maybe the Chinese government was retaliating. They have the second largest stockpile of 10-year U.S. Treasury bonds. Or some thought that some of the deals that were made by hedge funds were breaking apart because things were heading in such a wild manner. Nobody's really sure quite yet. We do know that Chinese government has not yet started really selling those government bonds. But we don't quite know what happened during those 2 hours.
Right.
But still, because it frightened the financial sector so much, that seems to be the main reason why the U.S. decided to delay the reciprocal tariffs.
Right. And China has a lot of U.S. bonds, right?
Well, it has the second largest stockpile. It's about, I believe, $730 billion worth of U.S. Treasury bonds. They used to have more, but they sold a lot of it, partially to decouple themselves from the United States, partially to control their exchange rates. Right now, the country that has the largest stockpile of U.S. Treasury bonds is actually Japan. They have slightly more than $1 trillion worth, while the Chinese is ranked second, about $730 billion. And then the third is United Kingdom. But the it just shows that U.S. may be very vulnerable, not through the trade aspect, but through the financial aspect of it. Because one of the reasons why people thought that the U.S. was doing all this was to try to reduce the deficit by reducing the interest rate on the debt. And you do that by reducing the interest rate or yields on the bonds. But right now, that seems to have backfired, and yields are, if they're gone down a little bit from the last Wednesday, it's right now around 4.2, 4.3, but still higher than where Besant said he wanted that rate to be.
Right. So you do see it as the Trump administration blinking then. The Trump administration would say that this was part of the plan, that this was a ploy to try and bring partners, other countries, to the negotiating table.
Well, the changes in the yield, the interest rate, it hurts United States as much as other countries, maybe even more, because they have such a large amount of deficit and debt that they need to finance, refinance, that this probably not only scuttles part of those plans, but it also raises the mortgage rates, it raises the borrowing costs, long-term borrowing costs for U.S. companies. And if what the Trump administration say about encouraging investment and manufacturing in the United States, if that is taken seriously, this will actually act against that.
Okay, so how concerning is the situation with the U.S. Treasury bonds, especially if we look longer term as well?
Okay, well, this has been less than a week, so we don't quite know exactly what is responsible and what are the reasons. There are several reasons that are coming up, but perhaps the most alarming of that is that the United States may have lost its status as a safe haven, that they have what's closest to so-called riskless assets. Why is this important? Because, well, if you look at international financial transactions, that those are built on so-called riskless rates. What are the interest rates that people charge if there's no risk? And then you charge additional risk premium on top of that. That's the entire way that the international financial system was built. And the role of the riskless interest rate was played by U.S. Government treasury bond yield rates. Now, if the government bonds are no longer taken as riskless, if people are going to other countries' bonds as being better or rather less risk than the U.S. Treasury bonds, U.S. will have to pay a premium to finance their government deficit and debt. Dollar rates will weaken, and that's what's happening right now. This is very unusual that you have higher government bond yields along with weaker U.S. dollars. That's why a lot of people are interpreting these numbers as saying people are withdrawing investment from U.S. Treasury bonds, the so-called safe bonds, and putting it elsewhere, maybe in Japanese yen, not necessarily Japanese government bonds because they're they have such high debt load, but if you're looking at currencies, then in Japanese yen. If you're looking at government bonds, then in German government bonds. But if U.S. did lose their safe asset status, then not only does the burden go up for United States, but also the international financial transactions will have to find a new basis.
Right.
And until they find a new basis, things are going to be very, very chaotic.
Right. Well, whether it was the bonds market situation, whether it was all part of the plan, the Trump administration has pressed pause on the tariffs, on the reciprocal tariffs, and much of the world breathed a sigh of relief, including South Korea. Meanwhile, though, South Korea does still face a rocky road ahead as Trump once again hinted that his country may discuss defense cost-sharing agreements in trade negotiations with its allies with the aim of seeking package deals, that he has described them. So how do you expect the tariff negotiations between South Korea and the U.S. to proceed now with this situation, with everything you've said so far in mind? And any advice you would give to the South Korean authorities on this front at the moment?
Okay, well, one notable event that took place, Trump accepted call from acting President Han Duck-soo before, partially because the acting president was the vice prime minister, perhaps. But it was known that Trump did not accept calls from the Korean government. This time he did accept the call. That may show perhaps that Trump is getting a bit more desperate to make deals because he's getting a lot of criticism both inside the United States and outside. But having said that, what does Trump wants? Again, no one really knows. Right now, the United States has said that about 75 countries have expressed interest in negotiating with the United States, but they will not give out the list of those 75 countries. Now, we know definitely that about 5 to 7 countries are negotiating right now, including Korea. It also includes Japan, EU. It also includes Vietnam, and India, but both countries have, Vietnam and India have said that they're not quite sure what goals the United States wants. They did offer, Vietnam offered 0% tariffs on U.S. imports. The United States, or at least the advisor Peter Navarro, rejected it. European Union offered 0%, and again, the United States rejected it. So we don't quite know what they want. There was an article in Washington Post that came out yesterday, Korea time, and apparently they're taking somewhat slightly different approach from country to country. So some countries, they want that country to buy more from the United States. Some countries, they're targeting more on non-tariff barriers. Countries like Vietnam, they want to make sure that they do not retransport goods that are coming out from China. So they want Vietnam or other East Asian, South Asian countries to sort of barrier themselves against China. It's not clear whether they'll do that because they're actually more dependent on China than in the United States. But again, we don't quite know exactly what Trump's end goal is. Trump's head of the Council of Economic Advisor, Stephen Moran, made a speech in Hudson Institute last week, and he said counterpart countries need to do one or more of the following 5 things. First, accept current reciprocal tariffs without retaliation. Second, reduce trade deficit with U.S. substantially by buying things from the United States like agricultural goods or energy. Third, increasing defense spending and increasing procurement from the United States. Fourth, invest and build factories in the United States, though theoretically, if you invest more in the United States, the bilateral trade deficit for the United States will go up. That's just accounting equations. And then finally, just give them money. Just cut them a check. Right now they probably are negotiating which of these 5 things that Korea will do at which balance, what weight will they give each. But we don't know exactly what Trump wants. And even Trump, he seems to change his mind every day. Now, on Friday, U.S. time, Trump said that he will remove tariffs on consumer electronics, that reduced the tariffs on China substantially. In fact, a lot of people complained because then exports from China will become cheaper than electronic goods made in the United States because United States companies still had to pay tariffs on intermediate goods.
Right.
And so on Sunday, he said that he will put tariffs on semiconductors and consumer electronics in the near future. So again, he seems to be changing his mind daily. And under that condition, I'm not sure what you can negotiate.
Right. And meanwhile, one country that has, of course, been hit with reciprocal tariffs is China. And there's been increasing tit-for-tat tariffs between the two countries. Last Friday, China increased its tariffs on U.S. imports to 125%, hitting back against Trump's decision to hike duties on Chinese goods to 145% amid this escalating trade war between the two biggest economies. How do you view this tit-for-tat hikes between the US and China? Is there an endgame strategy here? And do you think there's room for the two countries to negotiate?
The Trump administration keeps on changing its minds, apparently. At the beginning, they said there will be no negotiation. And then apparently the last word here was that Trump encourages China to call him. So he wants Xi to call him. And he said he's waiting for the call. Of course, why doesn't Trump call Xi? Who knows? Removal or delay in tariffs on consumer electronics was thought to be sort of a gesture to Xi Jinping to try to get him to the negotiating table, but he basically refused. Mm. And then perhaps more seriously than raising tariffs, because once tariffs get above a certain level, raising it higher, it's not really going to cut down each other's imports all that much. If you have, say, 150% tariffs, raising it to 1,000% is not going to reduce imports, because it's already been reduced quite a bit when it went from 20% to 150%. China has begun to restrict exports of rare earth. And not only to the United States, but to all countries, they will require an export license. And that might be going it to the next level, because even the companies in the United States, they cannot produce electronics, high-level electronics, without these rare earth. And it's very difficult to get it from elsewhere. China has somewhere between 80 to 90% of global market share. So the problem has become a war of attrition. Who will be able to last longer? And there's fierce debate about that. The U.S., in a sense, is more exposed because they're fighting more countries at once. But China, because they are an exporter, they depend on large markets, and U.S. is the largest market. So even though perhaps they're less exposed to the United States can have a greater role, because they're either direct consumers or the final consumers for the stuff that China exports. But no one's quite sure who's going to win this war of attrition. So we'll have to wait and see on that account. And both sides are going to keep fighting. At least that's the signal that they're giving right now.
Yes, it is quite the complicated situation indeed. Finally, if we just briefly bring things back to South Korea before we go, the Bank of Korea's Monetary Policy Board meeting is slated for this Thursday, where they will make a decision on interest rates once again, of course. Amid everything that's going on at the moment, Professor, what's your outlook for the BOK's rate decision?
Okay, well, I think they will lower the rates if the following conditions are met. The first condition is that the foreign exchange market does not go crazy. It becomes less volatile. And the second condition is that housing collateral debt comes under control, so household debt does not go up too quickly. Now, household debt will go up because Korea's growth is going to come down quite a bit because of the domestic economic slowdown as well as the tariffs. But at least housing collateral debt should be kept under control. Mm. And then Seoul housing prices should be controlled as well, any rise of prices in Seoul housing prices will be limited. If those two conditions are fulfilled, I think the BOK will lower the rates. Now, the difference of opinion comes on whether these conditions are satisfied. One Economic Daily in Korea apparently did a survey of economists, and that survey showed that the majority of economists do not believe the rates will come down in April because because these two conditions have not been fulfilled. Myself, I'm in a minority point of view, but I think these two conditions are being fulfilled. So I think there's a very good chance that the BOK will lower the rates on their next meeting. But again, that depends on the foreign exchange rate market remaining relatively stable. Right now, today, the rates fell from somewhere in the 1460 range to 1420 range. So Korean won does seem to be strengthening. That's in line with all the other major currencies. If this trend continues for the next couple of days before the BOK meeting, then I think there's a good chance, personally, that the rates will fall. But if we see a volatility in the exchange rate market again, then we'll have to wait until May.
Well, I guess we will see what happens on Thursday and then perhaps take stock of their decision next week on a weekly economy review as well. But for today, we will leave it here. We've been speaking to Professor Yang Jun-suk from the Catholic University of Korea. Thank you for your analysis.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index gained 23.17 points, or 0.95% Monday, to close at 2,455.89. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ rose 13.39 points, or 1.92%, to close at 708.98. You can check for Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next up, it's Korea Trending, our daily segment where we round up some of the most viewed stories and issues on Korean news outlets outside of our news briefing headlines. And to bring us those stories, we have with us in the studio now Daniel Che, KBS World Radio News Editor. Daniel, hello, it's good to see you.
Good to see you too, Jang-ho.
What do you have for us first?
There's a growing trend of Japanese visitors to Korea buying back sacks of rice home.
So sacks of rice, that is quite surprising considering how bulky and heavy sacks of rice are. And there are, of course, limits to how much a person can bring back with them on a plane. So why is this happening?
Rice prices reportedly skyrocketing in Japan, and there are first-hand accounts of Japanese visitors to Korea that bought large sacks of rice to bring with them to Japan posted on social media. For instance, a homemaker in her 40s wrote that it was her sworn mission to buy rice in Korea during her visit because of the high price of rice in Japan. She mentioned that about 10 kilograms of rice costs around 8,000 yen, which is about $55. But in Korea, the same amount costs less than half that price of about $21.
Right, so using almost half their luggage allowance of 23 kilos to bring back cheaper rice. Considering how important a staple it is for Japanese people, this is surprising. How has this happened?
Well, a trend has been changing over the years. Rice consumption has been on a steady decline, even reaching less than 50 kilograms per person by fiscal year 2023. And various factors contributed to spiking rice prices over the years in Japan, including reduced labor at rice-producing farm areas, rise in fertilizer prices, and even school cafeterias. Some of them turned to reducing the amount of rice involved in their menu. The Japanese government also took drastic measures at one point, including releasing stockpiled rice reserve for emergency use. Some believe Korea should export more rice to Japan to help out. And then there are also rising concerns that Korea, which has displayed similar trends in rice consumption and rice production over the years, could be following in Japan's footsteps.
Indeed, and that's why rice is one of the few products that is protected with high tariffs on imported rice. It is quite the situation that these two East Asian neighbours are finding themselves in. Okay, now let's move on to our next story. We have news of a major Hollywood icon bringing some stardust to Korea soon. Can you tell us more?
He's a man who oozes charisma and excitement and enthusiasm, especially when he's meeting with fans. Tom Cruise has confirmed his 12th visit to South Korea, part of promotional efforts for his latest movie, Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. Cruz is set to arrive in Korea on May 8th. This will actually be his 6th visit specifically for the Mission Impossible franchise.
Right, but 12 visits overall, that is quite the connection between Cruz and Korea. How did it all start?
Well, his special bond with Korea dates all the way back to 1994 with a film Interview with the Vampire. Since then, he's visited for several other films like Mission Impossible 2 back in the year 2000, Vanilla Sky in 2001, Valkyrie in 2009, and most recently Top Gun Maverick in 2022.
Yes, he seems to be coming to Korea more and more often in recent years. And he's developed quite a great relationship with his Korean fans, right?
He shows a lot of love for fans. And in Korea, the fans are very courteous and appreciative of such a star. Cruz is known for exceptional fan service, going out all the way to show appreciation for the warm reception. He even responded to every selfie and autograph request during past visits. So that can be quite a nightmare for the PR organizers of the event. When they roll out the red carpet, they need to make the red carpet shorter in order to prevent the event from lasting for hours and hours.
Yes, his fan service, as they say in Korea, is pretty impressive. Can you give us a sneak peek of what to expect from the latest Mission Impossible movie that he'll be promoting?
The Final Reckoning is the 8th installment in the Mission Impossible series. It follows Ethan Hunt and his team. They face high-stakes missions. What else? Cruz is also expected to perform daring stunts, as usual, like hanging onto a plane and soaring at high altitude. The movie has been invited to the non-competitive section of the 78th Cannes International Film Festival, the first time the Mission Impossible franchise has been included in one of the world's top film festivals. It will hit theaters here next month, so fans can expect an action-packed experience when Cruz returns to Seoul.
Sticking with news related to the film industry, the Jeonju International Film Festival is coming up soon. Can you tell us more? What can we expect from this latest edition?
This is the 26th edition of the so-called JIF, begins on April 30th and runs through May 9th, and 224 films from 57 countries will be screened during the 10 days. 126 international ones and 98 Korean titles. 10 films will compete in the international competition section, including Always by Chinese director Chen Deming. In the world cinema section, 25 films, among them I'm Still Here, the winner of the Best International Feature Film at this year's Academy Awards. Tickets for the opening and closing ceremonies will be available starting at 2 p.m. on April 16th. Reservations for general screening so opens at 11 a.m. on April 18th, and tickets can be purchased through the film festival's official website.
Yes, and what are some of the works expected to garner greater attention? Which are the headline grabbers?
Continental 25 by Romanian director Radu Jude is the opening film, and the comedy won Best Screenplay at the 2024 Berlin International Film Festival, shot entirely on a smartphone, a documentary style that follows a civil servant tasked with evicting homeless residents. The closing film is a poem from a strange country, a documentary by Korean director Ha Chul-young, which shows the day-to-day lives and challenges faced by Nepali migrants workers in Korea. Actor Lee Jung-hyun has curated the J Special Programmer of the Year section. It includes movies curated by that singer and actress. Her cinematic debut, Petal, from 1996, and Night Fishing from 2011, and Park Chan-wook's Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance from 2002.
Yes, it will be interesting to see what the festival is like this year at a difficult time for the industry. Finally, if you're looking for a unique way to explore more of Korea's culture and history, there's a rare opportunity that you won't want to miss.
The Royal Library inside Gyeongbokgung Palace, once used by King Gojong himself, is now open to public, but only for a limited time.
Right, so we're talking about the actual study used by King Gojong from the Joseon era.
Exactly. The library is located inside Jibokje, a complex built in 1891. It includes two annexes and once held up to 40,000 books during the height of its use, according to the Korea Heritage Service. Visitors can browse through 1,700 historical texts covering Joseon history and the royal family. The rest of the original collection, which even includes books on Western science and tech, is now preserved at Seoul National University and the Academy of Korean Studies.
Sounds like this place has more than just books, right?
It did. Jibokje was used as a diplomatic space. Kim Go-jung met with envoys from the United States, Britain, Austria, and Japan at Hyeopgildang, a hall equipped with Korea's traditional underfloor heating system called Undol. To Jibokje's right is Parujong, a pavilion that served as the king's personal study. Stands out because it has glass windows, which is unusual for traditional Korean pavilions. And one official described it as feeling more intimate, unlike the open-air pavilions usually used for banquets.
Okay, and when can people visit the complex?
The complex is open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. through October, but close on Mondays and Tuesday during July and August due to the heat. It will also close for Chuseok and whenever palace events are being held. Just a 3,000 won ticket or around $2 to Gyeongbokgung gets you full access, including the Royal Library.
And that's all for today's edition of Korea Trending. Daniel, thank you for bringing us those stories.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hello, my name is Anna Yates Liu, assistant professor from the Department of Korean Music at Seoul National University. You are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
It's time now for Monday Sports Roundup, where we discuss the latest sporting results, headlines and stories coming out of Korea. And I'm delighted to say that we have with us on the line now a regular contributor, sports reporter Yoo Ji-ho from the Yonhap News Agency. Ji-ho, hello. It's great to have you with us again.
Yeah, it's great to be here too.
Okay, so we start with a feel-good story from last week. The Korean volleyball legend Kim Young-young enjoyed a storybook ending to her illustrious career last Tuesday. She helped her team, the Hunguk Life Pink Spiders, win the Women's V-League title in her final match, and she grabbed the MVP award in the process as well. It's what she's been aiming for since her return to Korea in 2021. But, Ji-ho, it wasn't easy, was it? It was a fittingly dramatic finish to her career.
Yeah, it was not easy. I mean, it almost didn't happen. The Hunguk Life defeated Jeong Kwan-jang Red Sparks in a five-set thriller in Game 5 of the Women's V-League Finals on Tuesday at their home in Incheon. And all five sets were decided by 2 points, 26-24, 26-24, and then 24-26, 23-25, and finally, final set, 15-13. Kim Young-kyung scored her season-high 34 points and recorded a career-best 7 blocks in this victory and was voted the unanimous finals MVP. So this team's 5th title and their first since 2019 and the 4th time they won both the regular season title and the championship final in the same year. So Hunguk Life won the first 2 matches of the finals and appeared poised for a 3-match sweep before Jeong Kwan-jang rallied to win the next 2 at home to force Game 5. And Hunguk Life trailed 10-9 in the 5th set, so some nervous times among, Kim Young-jung fans there, before an opponent error and Kim's spike put them up 11-10, and they were tied at 12-12, and Hunguk Life scored 2 quick points to set a match point, championship point, at 14-12. Jeong Kwan-jang got a point back to save match point, but Hunguk Life clinched the title on the successful spike by Tuku Burku Yoo's gank on the final point. So Kim Young-kyung, like you said, after she returned from overseas, had runner-up finishes in 21, 23, and again 24. So announced in the late part of the regular season that she was going to retire after the postseason end. And she was able to go out on top as the champion and also the finals MVP.
Indeed, it was her last dance, a crowning moment that she deserved for everything she's done for Korean volleyball over the years. I mean, Ji-ho, how would you describe her legacy? She was a once-in-a-generation talent, wasn't she?
She was, and, you know, she's got all these records, even though she didn't actually play a lot in the V-League. She spent more time overseas than in the V-League in Korea. But she's, you know, she's got all those points, all those records, and, you know, obviously her legacy, her place in Korean, not just in volleyball, just Korean sports annals is pretty secure. You know, she was not just one of the best volleyball players, but just one of the best athletes, period, in her generation in Korean sports. You know, she had some big moments in the Olympic Games, namely in London 2012, you know, leading the team to the fourth place finish, losing to Japan in the bronze medal match. Even though Korea did not win a medal, Kim was still voted the MVP of the tournament. And of course, in Tokyo in 21, underdog team, nobody gave them any chance. Kim Yeon-gum grabbed the team by the collar, dragged them to the semifinals. They ended up losing that and plus also the bronze medal match. But one of the feel-good stories coming out of the Tokyo Games during the pandemic years. So some big international moments. Also club-wise, she had some success in Turkey, winning the European Champions League titles, the MVP awards there, placed also in China and Japan as well. Again, one of the very best athletes in any sports in Korea of her generation in the last 10, 15 years.
Yes, and it's a shame that the curtain has come down now on her playing career. But do we know what the future holds for Kim? Perhaps it's too early to say, but is she open to coaching?
It is too early to say, but I think she's open to it. You know, she has hinted that she would like to coach at some point and would like to take some training programs in the U.S. or somewhere overseas. But she has also said she's going to take some time off before making any decision on her career beyond playing. She's going to leave all the different possibilities open. You know, she's very articulate, very well-spoken, very also extroverted, I guess. She makes a great personality on TV. So maybe some commentating opportunities might come up as well. But according to her agency, she plans to take a trip to Europe later this week, take some vacation and take some time off, well-deserved time off. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, she's not going to rush into any decision at this point. But I get the sense that she's potentially open to coaching at some point.
Sure, we'll be looking out to see if she does return to the sport in some capacity in the future. But in the meantime, we hope she enjoys her retirement. Okay, let's turn next to the Domestic Baseball League. In the KBO, the defending champions, Kia Tigers, fell to last place for the first time in 2 years on Saturday. They did bounce right back up with a win on Sunday. They're trying to weather the storm until their injured stars come back. Gio, how are they faring?
Yeah, so they're 7-10 after defeating the SSG Lenders 11-5 on Sunday to snap a two-game losing streak. The Kyung Heroes fell to last place after a 7-1 loss to Hanwha Eagles. So still a very early in the season that the Tigers should be able to climb further, only half a game back of fifth place Lotte Giants at this point. Right now, they're without their reigning MVP, Kim Do-young, who hurt his hamstring on opening day back on March 22nd. So he's going to get into rehab games soon in the minor leagues. And the hope was he was going to be able to come back in the coming days. But the results of the latest test came back just moments ago. And the Tigers said he's not fully healed. He's going to be re-evaluated next week. Their all-star shortstop, Park Chan-ho, came back after missing 12 days of action. He returned on April the 5th. Second baseman, Kim Sun-bin, had to resume training after being sidelined with calf injury. But on bad news, their key relief pitcher, Kwak Do-gyu, is out for season with elbow injury. He's going to undergo surgery pretty soon. Bad news there on the pitching front, but at least they're getting healthier on the position player side.
Yes, with all their injuries, it'll feel like they haven't really been able to get started this season yet, but they will perhaps be able to turn it around soon. Meanwhile, the LG Twins, the 2023 champions, mm-hmm. they're cruising along nicely. They've won 14 of their first 17 games so far. But they have a potentially challenging week coming up, right?
Yeah, so I think this is going to be the really first test of the season because so far they've had a relatively soft schedule, playing most of the teams that didn't make the postseason last year. But this week, they're going to run into the Samsung Lions for 3 games at home for the midweek series. First meeting between these two teams, the Lions 10-8 after losing 2 in a row, but they're neck and neck with the Twins near the top of the leaderboard in key offensive categories. 110 runs scored, that's one more than the Twins, and 21 homers by Samsung, three more than LG to lead the KBO. And then after that, the Twins will visit second place SSG Lenders, who are not expected to contend this season. Their pitching has held up pretty nicely so far, despite some early absences, but their offense is tied for last place with only 59 runs scored. So Guillermo Heredia is out with a right leg injury. Their slugger Trezeng has not played this season yet with right hamstring injury, but for now, their pitchers are carrying they're doing the heavy lifting to put them in second place right now.
Okay, let's turn next to the playoffs of the Korean Basketball League, where Daegu Kogyas and Ulsan Mobis each won their first games of the opening round series. Let's first talk about Kogyas's victory first, Yu.
Sure. On Saturday, Kogyas defeated the home team Suwon KT 67-64 to take the opening game of this best-of-five first-round showdown. The team that won the opener of the first round has advanced to the next round 50 out of 54 times, so 93% success rate. So Kogyas, they're the underdog as the number five seed. This was the first playoff victory since joining the league in place of Incheon ETLAN back in the 21-22 season. So KT nearly grabbed second seed in the regular season before settling for number four seed. They ended up dropping the first game at home. Kogyas center Mangok Matyang dominated the paint, grabbing 21 rebounds, 8 on the offensive glass. He scored 14 points in his KBL debut. Ho-Hoon scored 17 points, had 5 assists for the losing KT side. Their second game of the series is actually later tonight.
Meanwhile, Mobis got the better of Anyang Chungwanjang in their opening round series on Sunday at home. They've taken the advantage. How did they look in the first game?
Yeah, so Mobis won the first game 87-84 behind 20 points by Sean Long and 17 points and 8 rebounds by Ham Ji-hoon. Their game two is Tuesday. Chungwanjang climbed all the way from last place to grab number 6 seed and squeeze into the playoffs. They could not seal a victory, however, on the road. Now, the teams were tied at 42-42 at halftime, and Chungwanjang took a 9-point lead early in the third quarter before Sean Long scored 6 straight points to cut the deficit to 3 entering the fourth quarter. And then Ham Ji-hoon, the veteran playing in his 15th consecutive postseason, scored 10 straight points to put Mobis ahead. And Long scored a bucket and converted a free throw for an 85-84 Mobis lead, and Ham grabbed the rebound off a miss by Chungwanjang with 17 seconds to go, and Pang Mubin sealed the deal with 2 free throws. Johnny O'Brien scored game-high 31 points in the losing cause for Chungwanjang in this one.
Yes, we'll catch up on the KBL playoffs next week, but for today, we'll leave it there for Monday Sports Roundup. Jiho, thank you for those updates, and we'll talk again soon.
Okay, thanks for having me.
And that wraps up the show. We'll be back same time tomorrow, so we hope you can join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.
Thank you for tuning in to KBS World Radio. KBS World Radio is Korea's flagship international broadcaster, airing in 11 languages. The English service of KBS World Radio broadcasts news, music shows, and more on various platforms, including shortwave radio and online. Visit our website at world.kbs.co.kr, where you can find the latest news and stream all of our content. We are also available on mobile. To listen to our 24-hour service or our programs wherever you are, download the KBS Kong app or KBS World Radio On Air app onto your smartphone. We also want to hear from you. Visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/englishkbs and email us at english@kbs.co.kr to let us know your thoughts. Thank you.
Don't even think about checking that message or texting back. Did you know it only takes 3 seconds after a driver's attention has been diverted from the road for a crash to occur? Texting while driving is 6 times more likely to cause an accident than driving under the influence of alcohol. Sending or reading a text message causes drivers, on average, to take their eyes off the road for 5 seconds. When driving at 80 kilometers per hour, that means that drivers travel approximately the length of a football field with their eyes closed. At KBS World Radio, we value our listeners' safety and well-being. If you're listening to our programs while driving via your mobile device, please hit play before you set off on your journey. If you receive a message or call while driving, either use a hands-free Bluetooth device to respond or wait until you've arrived at your destination. You're not just putting your life at risk. Distracted driving accounts for approximately 25% of all motor vehicle crash fatalities. Arrive alive.